IFPRI Policy Seminar 2013 Global Hunger Index Launch Event, The Challenge of Hunger, Building Resilience to Achieve Food and Nutrition Security, held on October 18, 2013 in Washington, D.C. Speaker, Derek Heddy from IFPRI.
Yes, as Gwen said, I'm going to talk a little bit about this year's special theme in the Global Hunger Index, which is building resilience to achieve food security and nutrition. So first, just going back to the Global Hunger Index a bit. Is this going down? It's going down on mine, but it's not going down. Okay. Sorry, give me 1 minute. Going down on mine, but it's not going down. Oh, it's it. Okay, let's go. Okay, thanks. So why a global hunger index? First, to capture different dimensions of hunger. Second, to raise awareness of regional and country differences in hunger. Third, to show progress and trends over time. Fourth, to help learn from successes and failures, as Gwen mentioned. Five, to provide some incentives to act. And then to focus on one major hunger-related topic every year, as I will hear on resilience. So in terms of the measurement, it's an index comprised of three indicators: the FAO indicator of calorie undernourishment, the prevalence of underweight in children under five, and the mortality rate of children under five. And these all get equal weighting in the index, as you can see there. And then on top of that, the GHI ranks countries according to four levels: extremely alarming, alarming, serious, and low to moderate hunger. So the score varies between 0 and 100, but those are the categorizations there. On the 2013 GHI, there's 120 developing countries for which we report data. Most of this data comes with a lag. It reflects data collected over 2008 to 2012. We take the most recent country-level data available. Focusing on trends, the 2013 world GHI fell by 34% from 1990, from a score of 20.8 to 13.8. And as Gwen mentioned, there's plenty of success stories. I've listed just a few here: Bangladesh, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Ghana, Malawi, Rwanda, and Vietnam. But 19 countries around the world are still considered alarming. Several are also considered extremely alarming. Recently, also, South Asia's progress seems to have slowed down somewhat. This is just a graph showing you some of the different trends by region. The bars also break up trends into changes in the three components of the indicator. So at the world level, you'll see the progress I just mentioned there. South Asia got pretty good progress in the 1990s, but has slowed down a little bit. An opposite story in sub-Saharan Africa, considerable progress in the 2000s after some stagnation in the 1990s. East and Southeast Asia, quite consistent progress, pretty flat line in Near East and North Africa, and fairly substantial progress in Latin America and Eastern Europe as well. This is a map you might be familiar with. It's produced in the report as well, showing the location of global hunger by severity around the developing world. I won't talk too much about that. No huge surprises, I think. We can come back to that in question time. Okay, now to this year's special topic: understanding resilience for food security, for food and nutrition security. So this is a very topical issue. If you think about resilience, some of the challenges facing poor people: we had global food, fuel, and financial crises in recent years. Climate change is expected to increase the incidence of natural disasters around the developing world in particular. We've had major natural, quote-unquote, natural disasters in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel. Of course, those natural disasters have been amplified by political events and conflict in particular. And there's increasing cognizance that we can do better in bridging the remaining divide between relief and development. So what is resilience? Is it new? How is it related to existing concepts? Is it useful in a food and nutrition security setting when it traditionally comes more from the ecology literature. What does it mean for strategizing, programming, capacity building, monitoring, evaluation, and research? And what do we know about building resilience based on previous experience? Resilience to most people means bouncing back, and in fact, that's the original meaning of the term in Latin. But resilience in a food and nutrition security setting maybe needs a slightly more complex and nuanced definition. So in our chapter, we talk about three forms of coping with shocks. The first is the basic absorptive capacity. So here we think about a shock comes along and somehow you make fairly marginal changes in what you're doing to cope with the shock. So that's the standard type of coping mechanism for fairly mild shocks. More severe shocks, we think more about adaptive capacity. These could be incremental adjustments, changing the way you move your herd around if you're a pastoralist, or changing the type of crops you're planting if you're a sedentary farmer. And then with very severe shocks that really exhaust these kind of absorptive capacity, this adaptive capacity, we might think about transformational changes. An extreme case would be migrating out of an area or totally changing your occupation. So as you can see, resilience in this sense is somewhat of a unifying concept. It's not just about coping with shocks in the short run. It may involve more fundamental changes over time. In the paper, we also give an example of what resilience might mean in different contexts. So here we're taking the example of three hypothetical pastoral communities. Community C is increasingly poor and vulnerable. So in a severe drought, say the Horn of Africa or the Sahel, a pastoralist group might lose their livestock, and to the extent that they're not able to rebuild the herd. So they're not too great before the drought. The drought hits, they lose livestock, and then they can never recover their herd size. So in a sense, it's a vicious circle. Community B is fairly poor before the drought and then worse off afterwards because they've depleted some of their assets. So some examples here could be one of the coping mechanisms for some pastoralist groups may be conflict or cattle rustling. And while that helps them to recover some of their current welfare, they're essentially depleting their assets because they might face retaliation in the future. Community A is a more resilient community. Its coping mechanisms are positive. Maybe it engages in some kind of transformative coping mechanisms, for example, sending some of its household members to work in the city so that they can cope with shocks better in the future. So resilience is a very dynamic concept and quite nuanced for that reason. What are some academic perspectives on resilience? Academically, the new resilience paradigm has close ties to the vulnerability paradigm, which many people at IFPRI and elsewhere did work on 10 to 15 years ago, and as well as more recently. So an important question for researchers is, what are the lessons from that vulnerability literature? There's also debate about whether vulnerability or resilience better captures the importance of human agency and power relations. Resilience, of course, is a concept that's taken from ecology, where power relations and human agency are not so relevant. So that's an ongoing debate. There also isn't yet quite a universal definition of resilience. In the past 2 years, we've seen some convergence on definitions, but I'm not sure that we're quite reaching a consensus yet. There's also concerns of negative forms of resilience. The way we define resilience in the previous two slides, we're showing you positive coping strategies, but there are potentially negative coping strategies too, such as various groups resorting to conflict or crime. So there's the issue of negative coping strategies. And resilience shouldn't necessarily just mean to bounce back. When faced with really fundamental shocks like climate change, farmers, pastoralists, urban groups may need to change their behaviors and not just stick to what they've always done. So concerns that bouncing back isn't enough. Some policy perspectives on resilience. On the policy front, what's new? This is a valid question. Many people argue that resilience is a unifying concept for achieving relief and development. This, in some sense, could be an acceleration of an existing trend. So if you think about traditional food aid, taking food from a foreign country, delivering it to poor farmers or pastoralists or urban groups, That's really changed in the last 15, 20 years, a big switch towards locally sourced food as well as cash transfers. And one of the reasons we've seen that switch is because it was often felt that traditional food aid was undermining the resilience of local communities, particularly agricultural development. Along with that, we've seen conditional cash transfers, productive safety nets by another name. So these safety nets often have a kind of relief element to them, or always have a relief element to them. But part of the objective of these kind of programs is also to promote development. And we've seen what might traditionally be termed relief agencies engaging much more in development. But of course, one of the reasons resilience is so popular now is that there are still perceptions, even from these agencies, that existing approaches are inefficient or too small, and therefore in need of scaling up. An important question is, how would we redesign development practices if we were serious about achieving resilience? We can think of strategic changes. Are country, international development strategies really incorporating issues of vulnerability and resilience into their objectives? We can think about post-millennium development goals and whether we need specific items in there that really reflect resilience building. We can think about operational changes between and within agencies, between national and subnational governments, between different line ministries. We can think about portfolio changes. A striking feature of many different dimensions of our research is that there's more focus on prevention, and often preventative measures seem to have higher benefit cost ratios than curative measures. And we can think about experimentation. There's been a lot of experimentation with safety nets in the past 15 to 20 years, but beyond safety nets, what other kinds of programs can achieve both an element of relief and development? Measuring and evaluating resilience. A great quote by Chris Barrett at Cornell says, "Measurement drives diagnosis and response." So it's not a mundane statistical issue. Resilience is challenging because it's a very dynamic concept, but we often measure resilience, or think we measure resilience, with snapshots, occasional surveys over 4 or 5 year gaps. Irrespective of how we ultimately define resilience, we must have higher frequency surveillance systems to measure. We can build on nutrition surveillance systems, other types of surveillance systems, such as demographic surveillance systems. Surveillance systems were also used in the ecology literature to monitor resilience. And a good example is Helen Keller International's long-running nutrition surveillance system in Bangladesh, which conducted surveys on a bi-monthly basis. These systems need to be multi-purpose. They can provide early warning. Of course, we already have some early warning systems that have been developed over the past 20, 30 years, but these can give household-level early warning signals. They can provide real-time welfare monitoring. They can tell us about the impacts of food crises and other shocks. They can be used for impact evaluation, and they can be used for just learning about resilience and vulnerability. So these kinds of systems would drive accurate diagnosis and timely and appropriate response. I want to show you a graph here to just demonstrate the importance of this high-frequency monitoring. These are trends in child wasting in Bangladesh from 1998 to 2000. You can see the two observations there in the circles. This data would tell you that wasting went up slightly from 7 to 8% over that time. Now, this is the actual data collected by Helen Keller International on a bi-monthly basis. So you'll see in 1998, there were the severe floods in Bangladesh. It led to a very prolonged hungry season. But this also tells you that hunger is a very seasonal thing in Bangladesh anyway. And in fact, for most of that time period, wasting was actually much higher than the trends that I showed you in the previous slide. Finally, just to end on a positive note, we can focus on learning from success stories, which is one of the motivations of the GHI. What sorts of communities, programs, policies, and countries have had success in building resilience? What are the roles of different sectors in building resilience? What's the role for agriculture, for nutrition interventions, health, education, infrastructure, water, and sanitation? And what are the relevant economic, social, and political lessons from these countries? It's very hard to measure resilience across time and any given different indicator, but one possible measure of resilience is just dependence on food aid receipts. So this is food aid in kg per capita in rural areas in these countries. We can see some of the things we already know, talk of permanent crisis in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel, where they haven't been able to reduce dependence on food aid. Countries like Malawi and Zambia in southern Africa seem to have done a great job of reducing their dependence on food aid. And Bangladesh is a remarkable success story, which has reduced its dependence on food aid by 400 or 500%. Okay, thank you.